Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. I'm delighted to introduce you to Magali Anderson, a global sustainability and innovation leader. Magali is a former Chief Sustainability and Innovations Officer at Holcim. She now serves on the boards of Anglo-American and Capitalist Coalition, mentors startups through Creative Destruction Lab, and invests in ESG-focused ventures. Welcome to the pod, Magali.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you for having me. I'm really, really happy to be here with you today.
Well, I think the arc of your career is a fascinating one. So now you're a board member in major organizations, leading innovation, sustainability initiatives at major organizations. But in the past, you started as a young lady on an oil rig at the age of 22. Tell us a little bit about what that was like. And what lessons are you bringing to the organizations that you work with today from that start?
Yeah, wow. Starting quite some years ago. I guess, you know, it's one of those where you can tell what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So It's definitely one of those. And remember, it was a time, I know maybe some of the people listening will not relate to that at all, but it was a time where internet did not exist. So social media did not exist. Nothing like that existed. So I went there not knowing what I was up to, not having anyone trying to tell me that what I was trying to do was completely impossible. And That's why I went there. And I'm using all those big words on purpose because you have to think of a young girl, 22 years old, coming out of her countryside, haven't seen the world, anything, ending up wearing coveralls, hard hats and all, on an offshore rig at the middle of the sea with 80 men alone. And without any type of support, either local or remote, because there was not a woman to start with, my male colleagues, of course, were very supportive, but you still need sometimes to be able to talk to people of your kind and no way to contact anyone outside to support you. So I think in terms of character building, it's been a huge step, but also in terms of understanding what the reality of the field is. And that has driven me my entire career, which is I've always, when I was climbing the ladder, I think the thing I was always the most afraid of was to be one of those ivory tower bosses who come up with those incredible ideas, incredible plans that look fantastic on the paper, and you just can't implement at all because they are so far away from reality of
from
the world.
Real humans in the organization.
From real humans, exactly. Yeah. So I think this is all the thing that first experience brought to me, and I've tried to nurture and to keep my entire career all the way to today.
Well, the reason I wanted to start here is last time we spoke, one of the things that you've said really stuck with me, which is we were just debating kind of the role of communications team in communicating around innovation, around sustainability. And it came out that the theme of was that the communications is too important to be just left to the communicators, because it actually needs to be something that's actionable to everyday members of the organizations. And so they need to make the right priorities around, for example, sustainability initiatives and in the way that it resonates with them and aligns in a way that aligns with the goals and priorities that work for them. And I think for to have that incentive, you can't just have a big picture, beautiful strategy with all the right buzzwords. You had to really feel what the leaders and, you know, folks in the field would be feeling as they're consuming the messages that you're producing. Am I capturing that insight right? And, you know, maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I just want first to clarify something. I always work greatly with communication people. I love communication, and I do myself, I try at least to do a lot of communication. So that was not a criticism with
Yes.
communication people, just in
Yes.
case of doubt, because that could be easily badly
Taking out of
interpreted.
context. Yes, we don't want
Taking out of context, exactly. No, I think it's a famous story of, is a dog wagging the tail, or is a tail wagging the dog at the end
to.
of the day? And I think communication is a fantastic tool, and we need communication. We need, I mean, nowadays, and I sound like a old when I say that, but a lot of things go through communication, including political decisions, etc. Communication has taken a completely central role in everything we do in society. However, where we have to be careful is if that communication is not ingrained with science, with reality of the world, then it can quite easily derive in things we don't want to see, and that we see sometimes happening in some countries on the political side. So you could make the same parallel with the sustainability side. So, and that's why, again, I love communication, but I always love to make sure that everything we say is 100% robust, can be fully checked, is fully sourced, and nothing in there. And I've had a few fights sometimes with communication people because it is their job. I mean, they get trained at school to make stories beautiful, and I get that. And I understand you have to make a story beautiful to reach people, which is great, but sometime on the way of making the story beautiful, you tend to exaggerate a few things, and you get out of the reality, and you get out of the things. And this is where you can enter sometimes greenwashing territory, etc. And that's why I think communication is an incredibly powerful and important tool. It just has to be managed in collaboration with science-based fact-checking and everything else.
So let's talk about you know, what is this backlash against greenwashing that happened, and what can we do to address that, right? Like this is obviously in the significant way happening in the US, but I think there is implications for the around this globally. What are you what if you had this a way a magical wand to, you know, to guide the sustainability leaders, the communication leaders, about what they could have done differently or what they can go do going forward differently to not let the word greenwashing really kind of become part of the lingo around the profession.
So I definitely don't have a magic wand, and I wouldn't try to go back too much in time trying to figure out what could have been done differently, because in all fairness, it doesn't bring much value. It's always easy once you have seen the result and you have all the information after the fact to explain how you would have done a better job. So I never do that. I'd rather look at the future. I think it's very concerning, because the more climate change is impacting our life, and I don't think there's a single person in the world today who hasn't been impacted by climate change in the last 12 months. You either have been impacted because your house has been flooded, the village next door to you has been flooded, you have had electricity shortcut because whatever happened, or you've got shortage of supply of something. We all have been
Or like
impacted.
today, you're having allergies related to pollution, as we're
You're
guessing,
right,
right? So,
exactly.
yeah.
If my eyes are a bit red, and I told you that when we started, or just before we started, I was never allergic in my life. I'm now having this huge allergy crisis, and I read about it. Apparently, pollen, there's people who now die of pollen allergy, because the pollen push are so strong that people who are not allergic become allergic. People who are allergic are in huge trouble. So I think we all suffer today. So we would normally think, in a nicer world, you would think, well, if we all have been impacted, and never in a positive way, except maybe when you can go to the beach and swim in a much later, much advanced towards winter than you normally do. So some people might find it positive for that, but for everything else, it's absolutely negative. So you would think, okay, now that the scientific has been warning us for so many years, now that what they are saying is coming to reality, we are seeing it, all of us, we can't say any of us has not seen it. How come we are still denying? So, and you know, I am not a psychologist or by any kind, but I think there is many reasons to this. One of them is, well, the guilt factor. There's nothing worse than feeling guilty about something than denying it. You continue to fight. It's when you have made a mistake that instead of, we are in such societies that instead of saying, oh, sorry, I made a mistake, I was wrong, now let's, which would be great, by the way, including in leadership style, would be fantastic if people could do that. But in general, people prefer to, it pushes them even more to continue to be wrong, to just, I don't know, this guilt factor. I don't know how philosophical people define it, but it's terrible. But the one that worries me even more is the fatalistic factor. All the people who give up. But I hear more and more people saying, I know I shouldn't eat meat, but hey, we're running into a wall anyway, so may as well enjoy the last mile. And that, I think, is that worries me even more, because people who could be fighting and could be balancing the others, who the deniers, a lot of them have just given up. And I don't know what to do about that. Frankly, if I had a magic stick and a way to influence people to change their behavior tomorrow morning, I would do it. If I had a magic stick to change the legal framework of the countries, I would love to do it. But you know, we are just a few days away from COP30, and we have all seen what the result is. Once again, the fossil fuel worlds are not part of the global agreement. So I'm not saying I'm part of the people who are giving up hope, but that forum, which should be the place where new legislation and new legal framework are coming out, at the moment does not manage to work. And it's not big, I mean, you that was a COP that was at the middle of the Amazon forest in super hot environment, where they could actually physically feel during the COP the impact of climate change. But that didn't change anything on the negotiation. So yes, I won't say I'm pessimistic, because I'm a very optimistic person, but let's say I've seen brighter future in the
Right.
past.
So it's sort of the this year is going to be harder than last year, but don't worry, the next year is going to be even worse type of phenomenon. So it's not a very p positive
Well,
outlook.
if
And
you,
yeah, and what do you think could?
yeah,
Sorry, go
so
ahead.
just Alexa, what I meant by, if you know the wall is coming, you may as well enjoy it. If you knew you were going to die in 6 months from now, you would start eating everything you love, and you would start doing all kind of crazy thing, even though you know you put your health at risk, because you don't care, you know you're going to die anyway. And I'm wondering how much of
No,
that
I
is
didn't.
happening.
All right. So it feels like from your point of view, the one of the ways to reframe the way we look at the world is that almost going back to the, I guess, the tradition of thinking about the like what do we pass on to the future generations as part of our responsibility as stewards is has something to come to like an important context, right? So it feels like we're becoming too short-term oriented
Yeah, no, I
and
think
not
you're
taking that
right.
responsibility, right?
You're right. I mean, there's a book, it's called The Good Ancestors. I don't know if you've read it, but I advise
No.
anyone to read it, which is exactly talking about that, of how we transmit. And it compares climate change with the planet being a big frog that is in that water that start going up and fall asleep and under boiling. And it's actually the author, and he's got a very complicated name, so I won't even try to say it here, but compares climate change to that, because he's saying in all those movies, Mars attack type of thing, we see alien coming to attack us, and because we are fighters, straight away it does thing in our bodies that make us fight immediately,
Right.
the way a mother is able to lift a car to free the kid type of thing.
Yeah.
But when you are in the situation that things move super slowly,
Yeah.
so the frog in the water that is being bo heating
Boiled.
up, that's being boiled, you just fall asleep. And he was saying maybe climate change has been organized by aliens who have found that way to kill us way better than any attack they could make, which I thought was one of the best explanations I have found about climate change, and the way we act. But so it's a great movie, by the way. But really, and I'm not trying, I don't want people who are listening to that to think that I'm saying let's hope is lost. It's not. It's just that there is a game today of everyone trying to pass on the hot potato to someone else. So you have the company saying, well, we would love to do something, but if we don't make money, investors will not be happy. And if we produce things that are too expensive, our customers won't buy from us. So we wait for the customers to do something. And the customer is saying, well, I can't because I struggle to finish my month. I don't have enough money. I can't afford to buy organic food. I can't afford to do this. I can't afford to do that. So, and I still want to have a bit of pleasure in life. So I still want to be able to buy a t-shirt that costs 2 euros. And I know it won't last long, but I still want to have that feeling. And why can't I have it? And so the law should change. The government should change. And the government say, well, I would love to do it, but if I do it, the customers will not vote for me, or the voters won't vote for me, etc. So we end up in that loop, which is quite frustrating in all fairness, because the reality is the companies who have decided to actually move on and go on the sustainability way, a lot of them have done it in a really good way, and they have actually been very successful at it, both on the money side. So they have found a way to do it. So that excuse is stupid. A lot of the consumers, once they are explained exactly what's happening, they make the right decision. People are not stupid. They just don't necessarily have all the information at hand, et cetera, et cetera. So it looks like that loop of
And we want to
passing on
be, I
the
think,
hot
deeply
potato
as
would
humans,
work.
I think, like, we want to be more than just consumers. Right, I think that's sort of there's this fundamental assumption that yes, we're in late stage capitalism, and we could talk about that, but in general, I think we are when you ask somebody, do you want to think of yourself as a consumer? Like most people, like that's not their primary source of identity when they reflect on it now, but we behave like it is. But I think ultimately there's a desire to create, procreate, leave a legacy, right? Like we're all in search for meaning in other way. And so typically, any deeper search for individuals ends up leading that like consuming till I die, in glory of like, some sort of consumption orgy, sort of speak. Like it's not the answer. And yet, right, like we're ending up, as you're saying, so socially, there's kind of now this tension and the backlash against some of the initiatives that have taken place. So the question that rises for me is like, where do you see you brought up a few examples where it's working, right? Some organizations made it work. And we also talked in the past about where sustainability becomes core to the business model. And so we could probably dive into that where it sort of is, it's not one or the other, right? It's actually a business model choice. But what are the places where there is success? Like some argue some countries like France are leading the charge in terms of introducing new accountability measures. What's your take on that?
No,
What are the
I'm not
positive
sure I
spots?
would put France that high up on the
Okay.
things they
Okay.
have. They have done good things, and one of the things that I think where France is really, it's been, I don't know if the word lucky is the right word, but The nuclear initiative that was taken many years ago, many decades ago, is what makes the emission of France so low compared to a lot of countries. But it's not necessarily what we are doing today that is making it low. So I know nuclear is controversial, but as a matter of fact, it does reduce your emission on one of your biggest emitting factor. But frankly, today, as a country that is doing the best, I think, in my opinion, is China. I mean, they are on the way to revert their emission, and they are truly doing it. So yes, they are a hugely emitting country for many reasons, and one of them is that we have exported a lot of our emission there ourselves. But when you look at, they have installed more solar panels last year than the rest of the world combined. That tells you, right? That tells you on which journey they are on. So they are leading the charge, and they're leading the charge, of course, on electrical cars and everything else. Of course, with all the drawback when it comes to our local industry. So I'm not saying everything is great in China. I'm just saying if you are looking for an example of a country who is really doing something, it's maybe a bit counterintuitive, but it's China, I think. But going back to what to success companies, success that 1, 2, 3. Let me restart. But going back to what some companies have done, which have led to great success. Well, I could give you one to start with my own company or my previous company. When we started our journey, or we didn't start our journey, it's not the right word. We were already on a journey, but we were accelerating it because we had been on that journey for actually since 1990. So it was not something new. What needed to happen was a huge acceleration. So one other thing we looked at was to launch a low carbon concrete. Low carbon. So definition of low carbon, because again, everything has to be science-based, so you have to define what you mean, because it could mean anything, it could be 5%. In our case, it was 30% less CO2 than normal concrete at each country level. When we were looking at launching it, we hadn't launched it yet. We were studying the thing. Everyone was telling us there's no market for it. And it's like, okay, well, there's no market for it, but maybe there's no market for it because there's no product. If there's no one is going to buy something that doesn't exist. It's so you end up in that chicken and egg discussion forever until one day someone decides to say, okay, I'm going to be the chicken or I'm going to be the egg, whatever you decide to pick. So we decided to do it despite the fact everyone was telling us now there's no market for it. And we launched it within less than 2 years. We launched it in 25 countries the first year. Within less than 2 years, it was representing 25% of our total market. And I don't know, I think there's many companies who would love to launch a product that becomes 25% of their revenue in that segment within 2 years. So it was a fantastic success. And it was a fantastic success, sorry, fantastic success in terms of reputation, in terms of market, in terms of money, in terms of everything. So it really shows for me that sometimes someone just has to say, okay, we are going to do it. We don't care what the studies are saying. We're just going to do it. I'm going to take a 2 second stop.
Well, while you deal with the
Sorry.
pollution, so to build on that thought, and maybe we could extend it to another example, the other thing that struck me that we're discussing that's really relevant is that once you shift in the kind of hard and kind of hardware industries or old-fashioned industries from a product mindset to service mindset, there is that opens up opportunities for innovation and doing things differently. And that is, building things in a sustainable way, because the incentives are very different, right? You're not selling more cartridges anymore. You're delivering a service, and then you could build products that are more durable, more sustainable, and that is core part of the business model. So maybe we could also touch, connect the
I mean,
dots to that as well.
that's for me the ultimate way. And if we could move everything from product to service, so what do we mean by that? The first ones who did it, to my knowledge, maybe there was some small initiative, but at least as a big corporation, was Philips when they started to sell lumen or light instead of selling bulbs. And it maybe for the common person, it would be like, okay, and so what? And the so what is when you sell bulbs to somebody, you want that bulb to fail at some stage to get broken or stop working so you can change it and you make more money. When you sell light, you get a service fee every month and you want the bulbs to remain as long as possible. You really want that to definitely not fail. Now, when you do that, all your R&D now shift to how do I make my bulb last longer? And that's incredibly powerful because you have completely disconnected how you the money you make with the CO2 you emit. The less you produce, the more money you make. And think about it if we could do it with the phones. Think if tomorrow the big company that makes the phone I have was shifting to selling telephony services, and they are now, their objective would be that I keep my phone as long as possible. So they wouldn't come up with a new version of a phone every 6 months because they don't want me to change phone. But also my obsolescence and my batteries that only last 2 years, et cetera, that would disappear straight away. They would find a way to make batteries or to have a service where I can walk in a shop and get my battery replaced immediately because their model has completely changed. And think about washing machine. So tell me, Alex, your mom and your grandmother, their washing machine, how long would that last? Do you remember?
My grandmother washed with her hands.
Well,
I'm gonna
once
date
she moved
myself.
to the washing machine, when I said that, I was doing
No,
so for the
it's,
moment.
yeah, the it is funny that you bring this up, but I think it was the there was something about some of the older machines that lasted longer than they do now. If
That
that I don't know if
was
that
crazy,
resonates
no?
with yeah, they
I
would
have that memory of my mom having a washing machine that lasted 20 to 30 years. I can't remember, but was huge. Nowadays, washing machine, 5 years, max 10. So clearly, I mean, don't tell me that we have regressed so much in technologies that we are not capable of making washing machines anymore that last more than 5 years. And
So this
don't
is
tell me
basically
that
where planned obsolescence is sort of a
completely.
result of the business model.
So
And
if
then we,
tomorrow, imagine you are leasing your washing machine. So you lease it for a fraction of the price for maybe the lease would be a 10 years, you know, you take the price of the washing machine, divide by 10, and that's your yearly lease fee. Well, the company start making money when your washing machine lasts more than 10 years, right? So they will do anything in their power to make that washing machine last more than 10 years. When you buy a washing machine, they really don't want you to keep it too long because they want you to change your washing machine. Because then, and you could go on like this with every object, with every single thing you buy. So you could go on with, I don't know. There's people who rent their clothes. There's people who you could rent jewelry. You could, you know, you could go on the leasing model. And once you do that, again, you are going into for a company into putting all your money into making all your items last longer. Now, it's not that easy. And it's not that easy because you actually change the DNA of the company when you do that. You are not just anymore. If that phone company becomes a telephony services company, it's a complete different business model.
Yeah,
It's a complete different way of talking to consumers or to people, if you don't want to call them consumers, et cetera, et cetera. And I was talking to the CEO of Philips and asked them how they did it. And they told me they couldn't make it just a department of the company. They had to create a completely new organization with new people who thought differently because the others had been doing in a certain way for such a long time that it was really, really complicated to make them shift the padding the way they needed to be shifted. And when it comes to wholesale, there's something we were studying, because you could say, okay, but what about construction material? Are you going to lease concrete? You know, actually, there are also ways to do it in concrete. So we could lease. We were having a partnership with MIT to make structural beams that are repurposable. So you build something with it, and you want to change the purpose of that building after some years because it was a warehouse. Now you want to build an office. Typically, you would have to destroy because everything that's structural normally stays in the ground. Well, we had created structural beams that you could just move and move to another purpose or to another place. So that was one of the things we were working on. But the other one that was really interesting is if you look at a slab, a building slab, it so represents about 40% of the CO2 of a tower building, of a multi-story building. And what is a slab? It's a big piece of concrete, something that thick, full of concrete and reinforcement. Now, we were working with a university called ETH, ETH, the Swiss people would say ETH if you are
They don't pronounce
English
the H
speaking.
yet, yeah.
So we were working with
How
them.
wonderful it is to hear the way the French speak without
Exactly.
the
In French, it
H's.
would be ETH. So
ETH, yeah.
pick the one you want. But they had this incredibly interesting project where, inspired by what the ways the Romans were building cathedrals. So here you are. You know, we're not talking about super new innovation here. We're talking about the fact that when you make that shape, you only need to put material along the line of strength. So between two line of strengths, you don't need any material. So you can make the exact same slab with only 30% of concrete in it. So if you think that this is 40% of the concrete that makes a building, if you can reduce those 40% by 70 to 80%, it's a huge impact, right? It's 25 to 30% less CO2 straight away. Now, we were working with them on that with Holcim, but the problem is, once you have said that, as a company, Holcim, and we say, okay, why don't we do it? Well, how do you explain to your investors that you are going to start making slabs which needs less concrete when your business model is to sell concrete? If you start building slab, you become a competitor of your own clients because your clients are the ones who build the slabs usually. So how are they going to take it? But the thinking, if you could sell your slab at the same price that you were selling it before, but putting only 30% of the material in it, well, you become hugely imaginative of how you can make that slab with even less material. Of course, everything being normed and everything being safe, et cetera, obviously, that goes without saying. But the change it is on the DNA, because Holcim sells concrete to the purchasing manager of a construction company. So it's a commodity negotiation based on price, roughly, most of the time. Now I need to go and convince the architect and the engineer that we can design the slab differently. It's not the same skills at all. It's a complete different way of looking at how you sell your stuff. And frankly, I don't know if we are equipped for that. So the only way you could do it would be to create a new company.
New company was in.
But you know, it is extremely difficult to transform the companies in such a way, because it's not anymore, I'm going to reduce 1 or 2% CO2 every year because I'm going to add some solar panels, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. No, you are touching the core, the DNA of the company.
What's so interesting, it sort of goes back to the core question of how can we do change that's so foundational, and also at the same time, I think in terms of first principles of design, right? So when we think of Teslas, the idea that we're just going to be upgrading software automatically, and majority of the investment in the car is actually the software, and then we're able to upgrade it, that extends the life of the hardware extensively, or reusable rockets, right? Like, so these are sort of familiar examples for folks in the world of technology. In the world of software, I was very fortunate to be part of the evolution from on-premise software to SaaS, software as a service or cloud computing, where on-premise was sold, traditionally, big deal upfront, and then maybe some services revenue over time. And software as a service enabled a ton of innovation because you were basically selling a subscription, and it was a lower cost upfront and exactly what you're describing. And I would argue easier to deliver in the world of software, but it was still a very challenging transition. A lot of new companies emerged in the space of that. Some of the legacy company failed in the transition, some succeeded. And now we're doing another evolution in terms of AI, which I'm, fortunate to be a part of, where, some of the companies are already starting to deliver not just the subscription, but actually value-based pricing based on the actual end product. And so the parallels exist, but I think what you're saying is it takes extra dedication and commitment and rethinking in industries that are, hardware based,
Yeah.
like legacy driven, because, software is more adaptable to change, right? Like we have to change every decade at least, whereas some industries have been doing the same thing for 30, 20, 40 years, right?
It's if you look at the construction industry, we are still building the way the Romans were building. There has been zero change. And of course, the concrete is a bit smarter, a bit less this, a bit more that. But reality is there have been no real change. I think the biggest change that has happened in the recent years, in the last decade, is 3D printing. So the 3D printing, when it comes to construction, is actually a major shift, which I don't think we see enough. It's a major shift because you can build the same thing with the same resistance with much less material. And it's a major shift in terms of how you built. I mean, it's actually extremely technical to do 3D printing, much more, I think, than a lot of people would think of. Those sectors are quite conservative, and they're conservative because their consumers or their clients are conservative. The slab story I was just talking about, if you were yourself buying a new apartment in a building and you were told that your slabs were built that way, would you trust it? Or would you think, oh, I'm not sure I want to be in a building that I think could collapse because they put only 30% of the concrete in the slab, even though all the science says it's okay. But a lot of the lower carbon CO2 or CO2, sorry, concrete or concrete with more recycled content, a lot of clients, customers are saying, well, is it as strong? Is it going to resist? If there is a flooding, if there is a typhoon, etc. So you are also, it's a big shift. It's a big shift in clients' acceptance, and it's a big shift in companies wanting to take that risk because those companies quite often are very risk adverse by definition because that's how they have survived. So when we did the Net Zero Pledge, we were the first in the sector, and the biggest My biggest roadblock that I had to break was really the company not wanting to be first movers, because there was really that thing of but we don't know how the investors are going to react. We don't know this, we don't know that, and they are going to calculate the cost of all of that, and they will come up with crazy numbers, and they will and all our investors are going to leave us. I mean, I'm being slightly caricatural here, but just to say that in software companies, you always want to be first mover. It's part of your DNA. You created it as first movers, and you always want to be first movers. In a lot of the traditional sectors, the type of clients you have, the type of investors you have, they don't want you to be first movers. You know, they want you to follow a track that has been.
You're steady, right?
Yeah, because that's what makes you strong, and that's what made you survive over more than 100 years. So I'm not saying one is right, one is wrong. It's just different ways of approaching business. And if you don't think of it that way, you can't change companies, you know? And that's why I try to help company to move because I understand their challenges. I understand it's not as easy as saying, "Ah, oh, come on, guys, why don't you just do this magic slab tomorrow morning and we are done with it," type of thing.
Well, it's interesting. I reflect on our discussion earlier about the level of preparation that you've made in, getting senior leaders to buy into some of your ideas. And this was, about sustainability, but you were an executive, you were running countries at Schlumberger, so you've had this career of getting stuff done and getting buy-in, and then you applied it in this domain around innovation and sustainability. And you had some techniques that you were applying from the technology world, or from the ego world of taking us to the moon from Kennedy's speech. And then you were setting the frame of reference for the leaders in terms of how they could be like those other innovators that they probably respect. I think this would be really valuable to our audience, that many of them are trying to inspire change inside their organizations, inside leadership, inside their customers, right? Inside, maybe for the investor community that is more conservative rather than less, right? And we have these examples in technology world, but I think what's interesting is, can you take them from the technology or from government and apply them inside those industries that are accounting for majority of our economy?
Yeah, no, there are many things, and it's not one technique that works. It's a lot. And back to the beginning of our discussion, the fact that I was not that long ago in the shoes of the people I'm trying to convince, I
Right.
know exactly what they want to hear or what they don't want to hear. What are the things that will be classifying you immediately as this headquarter ivory tower person who has no clue? So I was always extremely careful on how I was aligning, and I'm going to give you several examples. The first one was how to get the pledge approved. So again, we are in this very conservative place. No one has ever done it before. I know people want to do it. It's not that people don't want, by the way, because they created the CSO job, the Chief Sustainability Officer job, because they thought it was important. So I'm not in a negative environment, but I'm in an environment that doesn't necessarily want to move the way I want to move. And so my first technique is, I would call it the surrounding technique if I was writing a leadership book. And my surrounding technique is really to say, when you come up with a new concept to somebody, to a senior manager, the majority of the time, that person will send it to his or her team to ask for an opinion because they've never heard of it. They don't know that they need to discuss it with somebody. So they will call their team and discuss it. The team members, if they've never heard of it, will do the same. So I sat in from the base and started convincing my way up. So by the time it reached a senior manager, when he sent it to his or her team, the team would answer, "Oh yeah, we've talked to Magali. Fantastic concept. We love it. You should do it." So this took actually a long time, but I knew that when I was going to do my presentation of the pledge, I only had one shot because once it's rejected, it's extremely hard to go back and get it approved. So I only had one shot. So that was all the preparation work. Now, the set the scene thing was that you are referring to. Normally, when you have either a board meeting or an executive committee meeting, you have to send your slides several days, 1 week in advance, so that pe people have time to prepare it, so that they have time to contact the people below them, by the way, etc. So I did that, but there was one thing I didn't send them. And just before the start of the meeting, I said, "Oh, I didn't send you that, but I would actually like to present, to run a short movie." And I had made up a movie using the speech of John Kennedy when he launched a project of "Let's go to the moon before the end of the century, before the end of the decade." And for people who know BHAG, BHAG, which is Big Hairy Audacious Goal technique, what a BHAG definition is something that you already know 70% of how you are going to do it, but you don't know more than that because you have, I mean, your pledge is over 30 years, etc. So it's normal, things will evolve. But if you know less than 70%, then you are in dangerous risk of not being able to do it at all, or not being credible. If you are more than 70%, it means that you're not ambitious enough. And I played that little movie where we see Kennedy talking, etc. And it was funny because it's exactly what you said. I was calling on the ego of the Holcim guys of saying, "Hey, let's do something exceptional here." And but if I had done that alone without doing all the groundwork of convincing everybody, I don't think it would have worked. I think it's a combination of the two. Now, the other thing which you should not undermine is how do you convince the people who are going to actually do the job, which is the operation people? So it's one thing to get the approval from the top, but if you don't have the support from the ground, forget it, it's not going to work. And it's really interesting because once I was in at one COP, there was this meeting organized by the LinkedIn CSO who was explaining how we were short of skills, et cetera, for the transformation. And the meeting was all about how do you explain to people in your company what climate change is all about? How do you train people? So people were talking about the climate risk and blah, 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 and all this stuff. And when it came to me, I said, I'm not doing any of that. And I'm not doing any of that because for me, it's a complete distraction. Because frankly, if the fact of understanding climate change was triggering action, we would know about it. We wouldn't be in that problem area we are in today. What triggers action in a company is alignment of objective. So nobody goes to work in the morning saying, I'm so happy I'm going to destroy the planet a bit more today. Oh, wow, that's motivating. No, people go to work in the morning trying to do the best they can to fulfill the objectives of the company, but also to give a bit of purpose in their life. So if they can combine the two, they will. If they don't, if they have the pressure of the company, they will always follow the pressure of the company because if not, they lose their job. If not, they lose their bonus, etc., etc. So it makes sense. I don't blame them. So all my work was into aligning objective, financial objective, and sustainability objective, so that the guy on the ground who is the one sweating every morning all day long to deliver doesn't have to question what he has to deliver. He knows because there is only one line of command, and that line of command includes sustainability. So I think I had shocked a bit everybody by saying that. But so, the guys who go to work, what they want is earn their salary, bring food to their family. And it's not that they don't care about sustainability. They just have too many other things they have to care about. And it just, if you don't make his life or her life easy with aligning objective and everything else, then it's just not going to work.
This is really interesting. And just one very simple example, I think, where we are hurt ourselves is that when we put together these, let's say, sustainability reports, right? They're like 200 pages, and there's some one big overall overarching goal, which is great for the senior leaders in the organization, but it doesn't help me in the front line to know how what I'm working on contributes to that goal is meaningful. And then, like, throughout the 200 pages, there are like great, like, for this area of the business, this is what we're doing, and this is how it's aligned. And this is there's a story there somewhere, like of a like that humanizes this and really does raise the motivation, because, like you said, people achieve their goal and it supports the business and they're making the world a slightly better place. It gives them this extra oomph in their step and an extra meaning to their work life. And it's sort of this beautiful thing, but somehow, because we're this either big goals or 200 pages and nobody could get to the page 194, which is really relevant to them and their business, that because that's gets lost in the detail, there's a disconnect. So
But
even though you've
yeah.
seen, so that is that kind of a in line with your with what
Yeah,
you've
I mean,
observed as well?
at the end was really coming back with a simple set of objectives which everyone can understand, a toolbox to achieve them. And I mean, if you were interviewing anyone in my team, they would tell you that every time they were coming up with a new initiative, and no matter how great it looks, my first question was, Is the cost of this initiative and the time it's going to take worth the sweat of the guy on the ground who is making the money that pays it?
Yeah.
If you can't answer positively to that question and positively multiple times, then we're not doing it. And same when we were, one of the illness of corporate people is to send huge requests to the operation in terms of collecting data, etc., which, by the way, AI is helping tremendously to reduce. But was the same question. Is it worth it? Is it worth the distraction of that people who are there on the ground making the money that pay our salaries and our initiatives? And you could ask that was always my first question. But again, it's back to I was that person on the field, and more than the
Yeah.
few years I was on the rig, I was P&L owner, etc., in my career. So I was that person on the field who was bitching about the guys at corporate level who were, and like, these guys understand nothing. I mean, they're asking me, this is all this money that was so hard to earn, they are wasting it in these stupid things. And that
Yeah.
always stuck to my mind.
So it's almost like it's almost these two bipolar things is on the one hand, you need to be able to strategically really think outside, and almost create new structures where there's pure alignment between sustainability and commercial success. And then if you live in an existing
In,
reality, you kind of need to align, make
but it's
sure
not.
that, right? Sorry.
It's not even a new structure. It's part. I mean, you just include it in your
Yeah.
objective things, in your long-term incentive or your short-term incentive. You just include it. It's
Right.
not that difficult, and it gives you a tremendous power because when you go and see somebody and say, "Okay, I want that initiative is going to allow us to reach our objective, which has a bonus link to it," and the person say, "Sorry, can't do it. Don't have time." I said, problem, no problem. I will make sure our CEO knows that we couldn't do it, so that's why he didn't get his bonus. That's quite powerful. It works really
Yeah.
well.
Yeah,
But you should not overdo it on
we are,
the
yeah, like I think look into incentives. Well, that actually brings me in, as we wrap up, brings me in the kind of the your current role. So those of you those that don't know, Anglo American has market cap of $43 billion. You're on the board, you're on sustainability and remuneration committee. So incentives and sustainability. How do you see your experience from bringing innovation in organizations like Wholesome, now being relevant in this board and advisory capacity? What have you brought back? Like, if you were back to step back into the operational role, having sat on the board now, how would you approach it differently from that perspective as well?
I'm not sure in the operation I would approach it any differently, in all fairness, because it's a bit too disconnected. It's a bit too far away. But on the board, there's no question that I think a board is very, I'm looking for the word. If I don't know if efficient is a word, but at least powerful or bringing value, maybe is the best word. It's bringing a lot of value to the organization if we have good diversity of people at the board who each bring their own value. What I definitely bring to the board myself is the fact that I understand how to transform a company from the within. And because I've done it, and I've done it in a very, again, traditional conservative sector, which is hard to move. And I think that's what you bring. So you try to help the executive people by giving them tips or things that has worked or things you have tried that have not worked as well, because
Right,
that's
right,
also very
right.
useful. So it's really it's trying to, of course, making sure that they do things that is the right things to do. But I'm really lucky that I'm not just lucky, that's also why I wanted to be at their board. That Anglo American is a company with extremely strong values, and not just on the paper, in their heart, in the way they do things. So I didn't need to do too much on that side. But it's really important, I think, to share things with them, and that allows the companies to move faster. And that's how I would define my role, is really sharing my understanding of how the ground works. And if they come up with an idea that doesn't sound like it will work, I am allowed to give an opinion on it.
Well, that's brilliant. Well, look, I'm super grateful. I think a lot of people in some of the roles that we support, whether they're, chief sustainability officer, chief innovation officer, chief human resources officer, want a seat at the table, at the boardroom table. And you are on the board and you've grown from a kind of organizational leader to drive this change and share, and spread innovation in industries that are, definitely not designed for that, but need to change and adapt with the time. So thank you for sharing that perspective. I think it's very relevant. And even for those folks that are in the innovation ecosystem, our, I think, big challenge in the innovation system is to bring innovation to parts of the economy and parts of the society that are more resistant to change. I think there's real art and science to that. So thank you for sharing that perspective, Magali.
Okay, thank you very much, Alex.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relayto.com, relayto.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relayto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.